KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Later on To the Point this morning at 11. 94.9 KUOW, it's 10:04.
Vitrum coram Deo explorata, ad conditionem certam perveni.
We were sent here to make what difference we can. To secure this nation, expand opportunity, uphold our ideals through the hard, often frustrating, but absolutely necessary work of self-government.
Government's role is wisely limited by the Constitution, and it can't play its essential role when it ignores those limits.
Those are some of the voices in the news this week that we will be talking about today on the program for our week in review. Knut Burgess, yes, what happened was, I'll just tell you, I'm sorry I'm laughing, but I just accidentally deleted all the information that I have by which we go down our list because, of course, we are not magicians. We have a list and we know what we're talking about.
We have it memorized. Yeah.
You. Skipping us. You guys have it. All right, good.
So what you're saying is you deleted the show.
I deleted the show. The show has been deleted from reality.
I don't remember what happened this week anyway.
Kenneth Bridgers, editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine and the Mossback at crosscut.com, author of Pugetopolis and also History of the Space Needle. Well, there was a scandal in the Space Needle this week, so we can talk about that. Cairo's been all over it, you and your Space Needle friends. Eli J. Sanders at Twitter. Eli J. Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you. That's at Eli J. Sanders.
Oh,
that's
at Eli J. Sanders.
Twitter handle.
Of course.
Nice
and
to be back.
Where have you been?
I was in Kauai. Hiking.
And you were hiking the...
The Kalalau Trail.
Yeah, man.
I got corrected on my pronunciation while I was out there. That is a serious, serious
That's
hike.
Impressive. I've been there once and I got like up through a little bit of the mud.
Mm-hmm. The first 2 miles. We did all 11 miles and then spent 3 days recovering at the beach at the end.
Wow. And then you had to come back.
Yeah. Then we did 11 miles back.
But... Amazing.
It's beautiful. Really amazing. Really beautiful. A really interesting collection of people at the end of that trail, by the way. Some people who just live out there. There was a fugitive who was out on the trail who we didn't encounter, thankfully.
Thankfully.
And just a really...
Oh, yeah,
really...
hello. Joni Balter.
Oh, no, I didn't mean it that
way. Joni Balter, the Seattle Times is here, too. Continue.
Missed her on the trail.
No, that's not... All right, fine.
I just didn't introduce you. But
no, that's right. Fine.
Jay Balter at Seattle Times.
No, at Jay Balter.
At Jay Balter for Twitter. Continue, please, because I would like to go back on your trip for just a moment.
We got made fun of a little bit on the 11-mile hike out to Kalalau by some people who were carrying less heavy bags than us. There's a whole contingent of people who kind of make their life out there and, you know, keep a camp out there and just supply it. So we're carrying these huge heavy packs up and down the hills and in and out of the kind of accordion-folded cliffs that come out to the water there. And we'll get passed by, like, a young woman in bare feet. And, you know, a shopping bag with her sandals in it on her way out to the same place where we were carrying tents and water and so on to stay. So that was humbling.
Wait a minute. Are there like a colonies of hippies out there who are and you encounter them?
That's pretty much it. We encountered a guy in flip-flops and a sarong on the trail, and he was headed out just on the theory that the valley will provide. You know, this is a valley that comes up out of Kalalau Beach. And the next day we saw him... And he told us he had just eaten wild boar that had been killed in
Whoa.
The valley and was being roasted up.
Lord of the Flies is what it is.
It's not far from that, actually, for some of the people who stay out there, but with a much more peaceful vibe.
Doesn't sound like a wilderness experience, though.
It is. Actually really is. Once you get past those first 2 miles that you did, and that probably a lot of listeners who have checked out this
Yeah, sure. Rub it in, man.
Have done. It's pretty wild, and there aren't that many people out there. So, and in fact, I think it is technically, it's not what we call a wilderness here in the Pacific Northwest, but it is a wild area. I don't know what the designation is, but there's no building there.
How was your tweeting at Eli J. Sanders out
impossible.
There?
Impossible. Delightfully impossible. There's no cell phone reception. The only way out is to flag down one of the helicopters that buzz overhead regularly, giving people tours of the valleys up above. Or you could try to swim, and I don't think that would work very well. No electricity, no cell phone, no computer, of course. It was wonderful.
Have you been out there, Skip Knute?
Yeah. Yeah, I did not hike the trail.
You did the 2 miles.
I did the first mile. It was the first section of the trail that takes you to the top of one of the fins that sticks out, and then I just went back to the parking lot. I'd seen enough, but you get this view from there of that coast. It's spectacular.
Just like to dream about Hawaii. This is a nice way to do it. I hope people don't mind. They're probably dreaming with us. Have you been there?
No. No, I was thinking of, as he was talking, I was thinking of the hike of the Cinque Terre, and which I did a couple times, and ran into some German folks who were appropriately described by the author Paul Thoreau as militantly nude.
Hiking on the trail.
Hiking on the trail.
Cool.
There was some of that.
Militant nudeness?
Yeah. Not so militant, but relaxed nudeness, I would say.
But the great thing about European hiking like that is you can stop and have a great lunch at a taverna or something. You know,
right, because you come through the towns.
Do you have to get dressed when you do that?
I thought so.
Those militant German nudes are everywhere in Europe. You can't avoid them.
Militant German nudes.
I'll tweet a picture of the Nepali coast from the trail. Just
please do.
Wanting to daydream.
And hold the picture on the militant.
Militant nudeness.
But that
right,
beautiful
I'll hold
picture.
That one out for pledge week.
Yes. That beautiful picture you had of the beach. That was nice. And the sun setting. You saw some nice stuff. All right. Fine. Fine, let's return to reality, shall we?
Clunk.
Okay, enough of Hawaii. But here, how about this for transition? A Hawaiian gave the State of the Union address. I like to call President Obama Hawaiian. That's where he was.
Well, some people call him from other countries.
Yeah.
In case you hadn't heard.
I have heard that, but he was born there and his formative years were there.
That was a world-class segue.
Thank you. I think that was pretty nice.
I think that was, whatever the, 4 stars or something.
Journalism awards are given for segues. I don't know if you guys knew that or not. All right, so what did you make of the State of the Union? How did you enjoy it? Were you drinking a glass of wine?
I enjoyed it, but I was watching it, that kind of thing. One of the comments about this was that it was Obama the way he really is. In other words, for the last 4 years in various speeches were him sort of holding back who he is. A New York Times piece, Charles Blow, was talking about sort of this is the real Obama. He's muscular in his speech. He's willing to say what he thinks. He did not hold back on the role of government in this speech. He was rather activist. I mean, one of the clips that I put on the Politics Northwest blog was about raising the minimum wage. That is not known to be popular among business folks. He wanted to raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour and had quite a bit of rhetoric about how, these people are working full time. It's not a living wage. In the state of Washington, by the way, we're ahead of that number. We're at $9.19 last time I looked.
By the way, was that when you could hear the pin drop in the Senate chamber when he made that announcement? There was one, I think that was it, where it was very quiet. And
the
tepid response would be
I thought
overstated.
The sort of moments leading up to the speech were going to cause Obama quite a lot of problem, which they didn't, because he was about to get split-screened. With his speech and what was going on in the California manhunt.
Oh, Lord.
So
they were going to split screen that?
Well, I'm just saying it was split screened until about a minute before the speech started, a couple minutes before the speech started. It was split screened. So I thought, how's this speech going to be if it keeps going? But it didn't. They gave him the whole screen. He also, again, if you're going to say that he's muscular and willing to say what's on his mind, he was perhaps most forceful. When he spoke about gun control, he said that the families in Newtown and elsewhere around the country deserve a vote on all of it. You can vote the way you wish to vote, but we as a Congress and a president owe these families a decision that's made in public and full discussion of these issues, and they deserve a vote, is what the president said.
Interesting that he saved that to the end, too.
Yes.
What did you make of it?
Well, I thought that was one of the most powerful moments, that refrain, they deserve a vote, they deserve a vote. And it went on in a lot of long silences, heavy with really just kind of the import of Congress actually doing something about this. We'll see where it goes in Congress, but I think that request is a pretty powerful one. Just vote on it. And it'll be interesting to see what happens if Congress actually does that.
What did you make of it?
Well, I listened to the speech on KUOW, actually. and the reason I did was, well, I don't have a TV, but I didn't go out of my way to look at it because I hate the way that they are always cutting to the reaction shots. I don't care what Ted Nugent thinks of the speech. I don't want to see his face. I just wanted to listen to the words. I thought it was a good speech. I agree with Eli that the sort of the rhetoric at the end of the speech about the voting on gun control was really moving. I mean, it was goosebumpy, I thought. I was interested in the analysis of the speech because the commentators seemed to be all over the place. Remember, Maura Eliason came on and was saying that he saved the rough stuff for the inauguration, and this was a pretty easygoing speech by comparison. And a lot of commentators really had that flipped. I mean, they basically thought it was a very contentious speech. And I think the way in which it was contentious, there was another analyst, I can't remember who it was, that said something I really agreed with, which was he really said, it basically presented himself as, look, I'm a guy who has a whole lot of really great ideas that the country really likes, and you people in the audience are stopping me. That, you know, he really was clearly laying out, here's what we could be doing, and here's what we're not being allowed to do, and we need to put pressure on these guys to act. And the fact is, Congress is being very obstructionist, and particularly the Republican House. And so in that sense, it was, I thought, a very a challenge. He's challenging the current level of gridlock. Someone else described this speech as somewhat Clintonian, and what they meant by that was it was sort of full of small ball ideas. And I thought that was also a smart strategy, which is you talk about the minimum wage, you talk about education program, you talk about stuff that's sort of small, doable, and it puts everything into the realm of the possible. And those ideas tend to be very popular. I thought that was a really good strategy.
You know what Obama's new favorite phrase is? Executive order. He is using that on a lot of topics to say, you know, and it's almost like this acknowledgement. All this stuff that I'm proposing, I've looked up some of the poll numbers on some of these things. Minimum wage is pretty high. Background checks, pretty high. So he knows he's got the public on some of the topics that he's bringing up. And so then he says, you know, looks to this Congress and said, we'll see what we can do through executive order, because it's almost like acknowledging, I know I'm not going to get it through you guys. So, but then there was sort of, as the week ended, a little bit of payback to the president, perhaps, with the Chuck Hagel nomination. They're all going bye-bye for 10 days. And they just said, you know, you want a Secretary of Defense? Wait 10 days. We'll talk to you later. Which was, and I don't know, I mean, maybe the concerns are very much legitimate and they really do want to think about it, or maybe it was payback.
Well, we definitely heard him describing how he intends to go around Congress whenever he can. And Joni's right, there are situations where you just can't, like the defense secretary nominee. But he was out on the trail, I guess, so to speak, these last few days, taking his proposals directly to people in different important congressional districts around the country, selling, you know, I don't think we talked about it, his early childhood education plan, for example, which that's, it sounds small maybe, but it would actually be a huge change in the way that we take care of young Americans and just create tremendous good outcomes over the long haul, according to lots and lots of studies. Another moment where we saw him talking about going around Congress through executive action was his discussion of climate change, which I don't think we've had quite as clear a statement about climate change, even from him in any of his previous State of the Unions. And so you have the president identifying climate change as a real problem with scientific consensus behind that it being a problem, and then saying, if Congress doesn't act, I will act through executive orders on this.
So just on that note, I want to take you back to that question that's just on that bigger picture. Let's go by way through of guns. So here's Obama on guns, and then here's Marco Rubio's response.
Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote.
We were all heartbroken by the recent tragedy in Connecticut. We must effectively deal with the rise of violence in our country. But unconstitutionally undermining the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding Americans is not the way to do it.
Did the Republicans' response, and we'll get to the water bottle moment later, but did the Republican response seem in pace with the way President Obama was talking to the American people? In my listening to it, it felt like the Republicans were still on a script from 4 years ago.
There is a problem when somebody simply says, can we have a vote? If you pull up a sentence that does sound like you've heard that nonstop for many years. Somebody's saying, okay, we all disagree. This is a country. We all know it's a very divided country, and we tend to disagree, but put the vote down. Take the vote. And to have someone then say, but, you know, law-abiding citizens, maybe does sound like a comment from a year ago.
What were you going to say?
Well, I thought the Rubio response was, I mean, he really reminds me of character from Leave It to Beaver, the old 60s TV show, Eddie Haskell.
It reminds you of Eddie Haskell?
He does.
Boom.
Yeah, he does, because and Eddie Haskell, of course, was always really polite in front of the adults and was some, you know, and then said what he really thought in private. And so he came across as a really nice kid, and he was the kid that all the moms liked. But then,
well, not,
you know,
June. She could see right through him.
Yeah. The thing about Rubio that to me was, you mentioned the script from 4 years ago. Well, no, it was the script from this election.
You're right.
And it was the script from maybe 40 years ago. I mean, he was just articulating, basic Republican policies. And the interesting thing was, you know, he was trying to position the Republican Party as the party of protecting the workers and middle class, you know, the party, and not the party of the rich. That the economic crisis and the housing bubble was created by government, had nothing to do with the big banks or Wall Street or deregulation. And I just found that many of the arguments that he was putting forward were just rejected. I mean, he was quoting things right out of the Romney playbook about Social Security. Nobody bought this idea that it's okay to protect current seniors but turn the future of Social Security into a voucher system. But, you know, he's pretending as if this is a reasonable policy that everybody wants. No, they didn't. And so I found this speech I think he's good looking. He's charming. He puts
all this on the radio. Good looking on the radio.
I saw the video clips. You know, I can see why they would want him out as
they hope he's the future.
Effective if you're listening in, I think, in a very superficial way.
Yeah. But I
didn't think there was a lot of there.
The only thing is that the next time he speaks publicly, he's going to have a water bottle.
Yeah.
One of those that you see some of the runners wearing around their necks so they don't have to do the deep knee bends to get to the water.
Well, yeah, this is one thing that wouldn't have come through on radio, but he had a sort of deer in the headlights quality when he spoke. He wasn't as polished as he'd been built up to be, at least to me. And then the moment where he kind of desperately reached for the water bottle, I mean, in a way, who cares? You know, we're sitting here with cups of tea and water. People who speak in public take sips of water all the time. But it was a short appearance, and someone who is trying to operate on stage at that level should let the water bottle sit for a little longer.
Well, the guys who do those rebuttals is pretty. It's kind of a thankless task because of all the pageantry and authority that goes around. I remember Gary Locke did it one time. He was terrible. And so it's not like getting that slot ensures that you're going to be the next, you know, the next nominee of your party or anything like that.
Almost the opposite.
On the substance, in terms of his Second Amendment response, it just recalled immediately for me President Obama's, I think, very effective counter of that in his speech, either it was at Newtown or shortly thereafter, where he said, okay, we have a fundamental right to bear arms according to the Second Amendment, but that right, as it's being interpreted by hardcore conservatives right now, is in conflict with some of our other fundamental rights, such as the right to peaceably assemble or just the simple right to life and liberty. And I think that the more he can continue to frame it that way, that we have fundamental rights that are in tension right now and we need to figure out how to sensibly allow them to coexist, if he can continue to frame it that way and put forward simple common sense proposals like universal background checks and force a vote on them, then that will be in line with what polls show a majority of Americans want to see done.
All right, I'm going to take a break, and I will pour water for all of you during that break so you're prepared for the next segment. This is Weekday.
Well, listen, my mouth got dry and I had to get some water. And when you give a speech, you have a podium and the water's right there. And but when you don't, then you'll start looking around, where am I going to get the water from? And I figured I'd better off just taking that water and taking the hit for it than being unable to pronounce my words at the end of it. It had been a long day of work. We'd already done an 18-minute recording in Spanish. And, you know, my mouth got dry. What can I say?
94.9 KUOW. It's 10:25.
KUOW and Balagon Theater present Next to Normal, a Broadway rock musical born in Seattle, featuring Beth DeVries and directed by Brandon Ivy, February 8th through March 2nd at the Erickson Theater on Capitol Hill. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
45 degrees and cloudy in Seattle's University District. We'll have partly sunny skies this afternoon. Look for a high around 55 degrees. Tonight calls for cloudy skies, a chance of some rain overnight. We'll have a low around 44 or 41. And there'll be rain at times tomorrow morning. Then it should be mostly cloudy with a shower possible in the afternoon. Look for a high of about 49 degrees.
Support for KUOW comes from TherapySearch.net, a place to turn when making the important decision of choosing a counselor, providing information to help those seeking counseling make educated choices and find psychotherapists who meet their needs. On the web at TherapySearch.net.
I'm Rob Wood. He went from being a Microsoft exec to running a nonprofit group focused on teaching the world to read. Room to Read founder John Wood talks about his journey on Smiley and West this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour here on 94.9 KUOW.
We are talking about the news of this week with Eli Sanders at Eli J. Sanders on Twitter. Joni Balter.
At J. Balter. You're struggling with that, but it's okay.
She is the assistant political editor at Seattle Times. And Knute Berger, who's just at. He's just at. writes at crosscut.com. He's also editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine. We had talked about Marco Rubio, and then you mentioned during the break, and we should go to that there was another response. There was the Tea Party response that Rand Paul gave following President Obama's State of the Union address. And, you know, he talked about foreign wars entangling us. He also talked about size of government. He talked about that we should pay attention to the Constitution originally, you know, he's in that argument, you know, the originalist. What do you think it means that there's two responses?
I've heard a lot of people say that they wondered about the sort of editorial decision to acknowledge Grant that there's a second subset of the party and to give them that kind of airtime. What is that saying, that there are two Republican parties? What is that actually saying? I mean, that was the main thing, was that, you know, we do have a tradition. We have a presidential State of the Union, the grand laundry list, followed by the other party's response. And in this case, how interesting that the networks are saying, sure, yeah, okay, there's two parties here.
By the way, how long have we had the response? I mean, the State of the Union is historical, but I don't remember growing up that we always would get during LBJ or Richard Nixon, even.
I think it's about the last 10 to 20 years.
Yeah.
But that is a guess. That is a guess.
But it's only been, I think, 3 years since we've had the Tea Party weighing in. We had Michelle Bachmann. We had Herman Cain did it last time. And now we've got Rand Paul.
So this is not the first time we've had the third edition of the Tea Party response. That's interesting. But I do think it continues to point to the schism in the Republican Party, which we're going to see play out over the next couple of years and probably for many years, and that we see in that new Karl Rove group that's attempting to torpedo Tea Party candidates who would potentially derail more mainstream Republican candidates. I mean, this is basically civil war.
That's with wild.
The Republican Party, this really hardcore, you know, in a lot of senses, racist wing of the party that has been cultivated by the mainstream coming back to bite it now.
Does the president have an opportunity here? And is this why he's continuing to focus on Congress? Does he have this idea? I mean, of course, we don't know. But is there a strategy by which you target? You already have Republicans fighting each other. So then do you target certain districts and figure out a way, even with gerrymandering, get back to a Democratic House?
Well, it'd be
malpractice if
he didn't.
Thinking about that.
But is that why we see him going to districts? I mean, is he going to, in the end, does he get to pick off 8 or 9 and just throw the weight of his office around?
Well, what they said was one reason they were going to certain districts was to sort of work around the representative or the senator on issues that they didn't think they could get the votes on, to go to the people in those districts, if it's for gun control or climate change, and go talk to them directly as a sort of way of working around them.
Yeah.
He said that.
Right. Yeah, no, Joni's exactly right. I mean, in order to get potential votes to switch sides on something like gun control, if you have the majority of American people with you, but the way that you have to go to the people of a swing vote district in order to push that. They're also thinking about 2014. They have to hang on to, the Democrats want to hang on to the Senate, and they'd like to make inroads in the House, which is, I think, one of the reasons that Karl Rove and his group is going out early to try and, they're trying to kill off Tea Party challenges to Republicans in the primaries, because they're worried about getting too many extreme candidates, and they want to pick up seats.
And I think this is for the Senate, not the House, right? I'm not sure that the Democrats see the House as realistic to flip, but the Senate, I think they obviously want to hold. And the Rove strategy, looking at the number of seats that are up in the next cycle and the number of problems the Republicans could have based on Tea Party challengers, he's trying to quell that before the Senate races really get underway.
Yeah, but if they concede the House, then he doesn't. All he has is executive orders, doesn't he?
Well, Obama seems to think that he has roughly, what, something like 2 years to do what he wants to do, because 2014 could be very difficult for the Democratic Party. Usually that's the way it goes. And also the openings in the Senate are not helpful to Democrats. So he's the way that I've heard a lot of people say, the way that he's sort of proceeding is, whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to do in the next 2 years.
By the way, Cody Keenan, 32-year-old.
Oh, yeah, I read an article on him.
Wrote Obama's speech at the Tucson Memorial, and then he worked on the State of the Union, or wrote it. I know they
he's the deputy speechwriter, becoming the senior speechwriter, I believe,
John
in
Favreau's
March.
John Favreau's going away.
You're right. Senior, yeah. 32-year-old.
It definitely had a different
boy,
tone, don't you think? The speech itself and a different use of language.
It
definitely shorter
more,
sentences.
More workmanlike to me. But
more workmanlike. Less. See, that's interesting. Less soaring rhetoric.
But also we saw that with the inaugural address, I think, less soaring. But I'm not sure whether that's also of the political moment for Obama. He is all about, in the next 2 years, getting down to business, doing what needs to be done on his laundry list of things that he would like to get done in the next 2 years. And it's what people want to see, by the way. I don't think there's a lot of appetite right now for soaring rhetoric. There's a strong appetite for nuts and bolts, get it done, move us forward incrementally kind of government.
And also, since the inaugural speech wasn't so much about the economy, there was the need to make this one more about that.
By the way, a couple of our excellent listeners said 1966, according to a couple of different sources.
Oh, good.
The history of the response. History of response to the State of the Union. All right, we shall leave the president and his travails and Congress and their travails for a while. I think, am I in a room full of Catholics here? I don't think so.
No.
Anything that you'd like to say about Cardinal Ratzinger returning to his role as cardinal?
Well, I mean, there were so many jokes. The best one was, too pooped to pope.
All right.
Sorry.
I'll leave that
Non-Catholic.
There.
Non-Catholic. What are you going to do?
What am I going to do? It is interesting, though, that this is the week he announced that he was going to step down, mm-hmm. setting maybe a whole precedent for how the Catholic Church will be managed in the future. The gun lobby in our state, speaking of the pressures, the gun lobby in our state is also putting pressure on Washington lawmakers at a time when they are talking about making some changes. What do you make of their strength this time around? They've been very strong in the past.
Well, here would be an interesting way to figure out what their strength is. And I've heard some folks talk about doing an initiative in Washington, which would be an interesting way to measure what is their strength, because there's one lawmaker, Mike Hope, who has been involved in promoting background checks, and he got hit for doing that.
Excoriated.
He got some mailers in his district that were just as soon as he was a good NRA player.
He's a Republican.
He's a Republican
cop.
He's a Seattle
Republican. Lives in Lake Stevens. That's where he represents Lake Stevens.
And he decided this time around that he was interested in background checks, which probably polls pretty high in this state too. And he is in trouble with the NRA. There's no doubt about it. So I do wonder, since people love the initiative here in Washington, what that would show. What would that be like? Because, and this is sort of what Obama's saying in a way, the Congress and the lawmakers, they get so much pressure that that's why Obama's calling for a vote. But in this state, maybe it would be a public vote. He's talking about a congressional vote.
The initiative idea is very interesting, because I think the NRA is probably more powerful in the legislature than they are in the state as a whole. You've got 6 million people, 3 million, I think, who are registered to vote or something like that. But polls continuously show strong support for universal background checks, at least the recent polls that I've seen. Yeah. So if the legislature won't get it done, then do what Obama's doing. Go around the legislative body and directly to the people. And you could have, if you kept it very simple, just the idea of universal background checks and wrote the language correctly, you could potentially have a very effective campaign if the gun control lobby had enough, or the gun control community had enough resources and brains behind it. Because it's been, compared to the NRA, it's been David going up against a Goliath.
I mean,
it's not...
You didn't mean they were dumb. You meant that resource-wise.
I don't mean they're dumb. I mean, you need a lot of smart people in a room to run an initiative campaign, and there are a lot of smart people working on gun control in this state, but the number of... You don't quite fill a room with them in the same way that you can with NRA members in an instant.
That'll be interesting, because the background-checked idea... Steve Litzo supports it. He's Republican. He's got some clout. And Rodney Tom, the Democrat who lined himself with the Republicans, he supports it.
Yeah. I think there are some very different attitudes about guns, given where you live. The urban concerns are different from rural concerns. And I think that's going to be in effect. And you have... The fact that you have some Republicans, leaning in that direction, I think is a good thing. The thing about – can I just tie this a little bit to the discussion of drones? I won't go into drones.
By all means.
As long as you don't drone on.
But there's an interesting thing here, which is that there's this, libertarian argument that if you do universal background checks, you're essentially creating a database that Big Brother will be in charge of. And eventually they'll use that database to register all guns and come and maybe take your guns or confiscate. So there's a civil liberties concern about that database. The interesting thing is that conservatives, while they don't want to see that database created, many conservatives have been proposing other databases, like Wayne LaPierre suggesting there be a database of the mentally ill. Mm-hmm. If that's not a problematic database, I don't know what is. I mean, especially if you try to expand the database beyond what courts have decided about a particular individual. The anti-immigration people, they want everyone to carry identity cards and have a database, basically make it so that we all have to carry papers, which conservatives used to be against. Back in the Clinton era, when this idea of an international or a national ID card came up, conservatives were dead set against it because Clinton was in office. And I just think there's this interesting thing about it all comes down to kind of who do you trust? And this it is there's very little philosophical consistency between, you know, fearing about a gun database but being all for a mental health database.
Well, just
it's just I don't, you know, it's there's a lot of incoherence that really has to do with a particular thing that somebody doesn't want to ever give up.
I mean, this is a small aspect of that, but it's this is part of the larger question about what we expect. Your Crosscut colleague Matt Fitzy-Verkirk writing about how Orca tracks your Orca card tracks your bus trips, and with a little bit of tinkering, you can find out where a person's going on the bus. Not all the time, but you know when they
and
use their Orca
with license plates,
and then they had the
well,
license plates.
Yes,
we are in a world where data is. We have to either have a different perception of data and how it's attached to us, or we are, because of course companies are doing it all the time.
Well, and so this is the issue with drones. I don't know if Knut came back around to it, but there's a bill that's been proposed in the state legislature to set some limits on public agencies using drones, I believe, is the language. And there was also a lot of concern in Seattle about the police department's purchase of two Dragonflyer drones for something like $80,000, I think. And the mayor at first had backed this, and the police said there would be limits on the way they use them. But you remember probably that really raucous public meeting that happened in the Central District a while ago where people turned out to protest against these drones. And the police, honestly, I was at the meeting, didn't have great answers for all of the concerns that people were raising. And now, in the midst of a mayoral campaign with Bruce Harrell, who's running for mayor, threatening to introduce legislation at the city council to rein in drones and create an ongoing discussion during the campaign about them, the mayor has declared that the drones will be sent back to their manufacturer and the police department isn't going to have anything to do with them now.
I was at a University of Washington School of Communications dinner the other night, and they were talking about, they were more talking about social media, but they were talking about in Europe there's a movement for folks who want to be able to have the right to be anonymous, the right not to be in all these databases. So the natural sort of reaction to all the data, there's data about every darn thing you can think of, is to say, what about my right to not be in anybody's database? I don't, you know, if the person was talking, they'd say, I don't participate in social media. I want to be anonymous.
These debates have to happen because the technology, as you pointed out, is making the tracking of individuals much easier. I mean, we're moving toward tolling lots of roads, tolling data, keeps track of who is where, when. There have been cases on the East Coast where people have sued to get tolling data to prove that so-and-so was having an affair with such-and-such in New Jersey and was, you know, for use in things like divorce proceedings. And just today, the Times had a story about this system of cameras that they're talking about, the waterfront cameras that would essentially monitor all the waterways. And the police want this thing. It zipped through the city council committee, zipped through the city council. And now everybody's like, whoa, wait a minute. Why do they need these? And meaning anybody who's in a kayak can be tracked or whatever. And I just think that, you know, the technology is making both using surveillance technology, but other people hacking into that and using it for other purposes, something in that those discussions and those kind of debates about what's acceptable and what are not, I think are going to be increasingly engaged as it becomes more ubiquitous.
I guess, but I think the barn door's closed.
You mean the barn door's open?
You mean it's open?
I mean, you're trying to close it, or it's closed already, and the technology.
With the red light cameras, remember when these were allowed, they were not to be used for the purposes of tracking people. They were to be used only if you ran the red light. And so now police are saying, wait a minute, there's so much valuable data. We could solve some of these random shootings in the city. We could solve some of the crimes that we can't get at, because we actually have it in the cameras. Some things people are seeing, you know, it's maybe at the corner where the cameras are, but we can't use it.
About 6 years ago, the legislature was looking at restrictions to the radio frequency chips and their use and that kind of thing. And the thing that that they were able to agree on was banning the use of those chips in cattle. So
I don't want those cows.
I think cows, beef cattle in Washington probably has more privacy rights than.
Well, they're not implanting chips in you yet.
No, not yet.
So. Not yet.
Not that I know of.
I think you probably on that score have about equal rights.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back and talk about some more local issues as well with Knute Berger, with Eli Sanders, with Joni Balter on Weekday.
KUOW, it's 10:44.
Support for KUOW comes from the structural engineering firm of Swenson Say Faget, with offices in Seattle and Tacoma. Working collaboratively with architects, contractors, and homeowners, as well as public and private sector clients, to create effective building solutions. More information at SwensonSayFaget.com.
46 degrees and cloudy right now in the University District. We'll have cloudy skies during the morning, but the National Weather Service says it should be partly sunny this afternoon. Expect a high today of 55. Cloudy, a chance of some rain overnight. We'll have a low around 41 degrees.
Ron Rash's stories and novels are often set in Appalachia, but readers everywhere will glimpse something familiar.
The writers I love most have been able to find the universal in the particular. Eudora Welty once said, "One place understood helps us understand all other places better."
Ron Rash's short stories, Nothing Gold Can Stay, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Just one of the things you'll hear tomorrow morning between 5 and 9 o'clock here on KUOW.
KUOW would like to thank Microsoft and its employees, the Real Networks Foundation, the Kongsgaard Goldman Foundation, the Cape Flattery Foundation, and our other corporate and private foundation contributors for their support of public radio and their commitment to building a vibrant community through corporate contributions and foundation grants.
I'm Rob Wood. Should the federal government pay people to move out of beach areas frequented by natural disasters? Warren Olney talks about that ahead in the 11 o'clock hour here on 94.9 KUOW.
Now, we are reviewing the news of this week with our panel, but, we started Valentine's Day asking you about the little things you do as a couple that make your relationship special, things like leaving notes, holding hands, touching cold toes at night. So we asked you to share some of your stories with us, share some of it on our feedback line, on our message line. And here's just a few things that you said.
Hi, my name is Suze. I've been with my partner for 30 years, and probably for the last 20 of those, he leaves me a note every single morning where he gives me a new name. He just makes up these little names for me, and he almost never repeats the name. He's thinking about me every single morning.
Hi, my name is Sherry. I have a sweetie, and his name is Scott. He's going to be in Arizona for 2 weeks during Valentine's Day. One of the great things about our relationship that keeps us alive and fresh, and we've been together about a year and a half, is that we talk straight and honest and true with each other, and we also talk 2 to 3 times a day minimum. And because of that, we have a really strong relationship that's getting stronger as we get to know each other.
Hi, this is Tom. We've only been married for 48 and a half years, so I guess that gives us a good head start. We have each found ways to do something every day for the other person, just as a matter of routine. For instance, she makes choices for me for clothing every day because I am a real, I have no sense at all to buy clothes. And I make coffee for her every morning because I'm a morning person and she's not. Those things have both been very endearing to us.
So thank you for sharing your stories with us all this week and every week. Every day is Valentine's Day, really, isn't it? You can always leave a message for us for a future show or some ideas or just comment. 206-685-2526. Our feedback line is 206-685-2526. Anything you guys want to say about anybody special?
I'm just really glad that there was also a guy on the line, because if it was all the women calling, I don't know.
Okay. Every day is Valentine's Day, yes?
Yeah.
And then we'll leave it there.
We went and sang karaoke for Valentine's Day last night. But
what was your song? Can I just try to envision this? What was your song?
You should not have said that.
You should not have. Now that you did. Wait a minute. He did say that. What was your song?
I have a whole list on my phone. I think my successful performance last night was Hungry Like the Wolf.
Hungry like the Wolf? You could see where I was going, didn't you?
Yeah. I'm not going to do a repeat performance here on it.
We have kind of an agreement that things like birthdays and Valentine don't have to be celebrated on that day. So we can do a Valentine thing for each other. Like this week, instead of waiting for Valentine's Day, we were able to sneak away for a midday lunch at a place that we both really wanted to go to, and because we hardly ever see each other in the daytime. Especially at this time of year, there is no daylight.
What daytime?
And so it was just really, it was really nice to kind of break away and do something like that.
Well, my son was supposed to be born on Valentine's Day, but he didn't make it quite that day, and he came the next. So I always think about him as our Valentine's gift. So there. And so happy birthday to him. All right, Seattle Public Schools, by the way, people passed the extension and increase of the levies, even though there were some people thinking that the second one might be in some trouble, had some opposition.
All the way to 71% trouble.
Not much trouble. Does it tell you anything about?
There weren't a lot of voters.
That doesn't hurt them.
That doesn't hurt them, and that's why levies happen in February. But that, so there weren't a lot of voters. There were something like 150,000 voters, and they got their voters to go say yeah to both of them.
People turned out. You'll get some bigger middle schools. We'll see what that all means. That was the debate. But whether bigger middle schools would be...
Bigger elementaries.
Elementaries.
Yes.
Sorry.
As well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plop down on some people's play fields. So we'll see how that works.
Yeah, that's
out.
One of the controversial ones because it's in the middle, it's on a play field up there.
Up there in Thornton Creek, right?
Near Thornton.
Yeah. Pam Roach. Senate decides it has no Pam Roach problem.
Not when you need her vote.
Yeah. So remind us. So there were charges of abuse against Pam Roach. There were investigations. She's the Auburn Republican. She's been around for a while. She has been known to carry a concealed weapon.
She said she doesn't carry it anymore. That she placed her desk by the marble wall.
She's been known to abuse. She's been accused of abusing staff members. So now all investigations halted, and that's why, huh?
She had been banished, if you will, from the sort of inner workings of the Republican Party. But this was the year of the majority coalition caucus, and they needed the vote, and so she was allowed back in with certain. Were there any restrictions? I can't remember if that. But there was this investigation going on that there had been a new, verbal abuse of a staff member. And so as this investigation was going on, it was, how real would it be? Who was talking to the press? All of this came up, and all of it was let go.
Yeah. Boy, I am doing a lightning round on you guys. I'll just jump around. Sick leave testimony in Olympia. There is this question of whether they're going to expand sick leave or not put the law into effect that they had passed the legislature. Republicans are opposing the bill. They say it's too much of a strain on businesses to ask them to pay this sick leave.
There's a battle about this. The original sick leave bill was not funded by the legislature. It was passed, but then it was, we'll get to paying for it.
Someday.
And so some folks are trying to kind of clean that off the books because every year when they're writing the budget, that number is often included in the amount of the deficit. And so that some folks are trying to clean it off the books and some are trying to expand it.
Well, what do you think? Is this a fair argument that they're making at this point? This isn't the time to impose another charge on businesses when they're trying to grow?
Well, set that aside for a minute. An additional thing they're trying to do is repeal Seattle's sick leave law. So it's not just that they want to take off the books a law that was passed but not funded. And I think it was family medical leave is how it's referred to in the state legislature. They also want to pass a law that says it's not any city's business to pass a sick leave law like Seattle just passed, and which appears to be working here in Seattle. And so you have two separate bills going, one of which will have a tremendously negative impact in Seattle. And you see the mayor who pushed the sick leave law as it was going through the city council telling the legislature to leave us alone, essentially.
But, of course, you do have I mean, you do have entities in Seattle area that don't like these bills and are opposing them.
Right. Well, you saw the cafe that was in the news over the it was essentially a tax on coffee that was to pay for the sick leave.
Yeah.
Which then was reversed after a lot of bad press.
it is sort of this classic argument. We're back. Same with the minimum wage. We're sort of at this classic old argument that we keep going back and forth on. What's the role of government to provide a social safety net for
well, people? Also,
and what's the role of private enterprise in that? You know, the restaurants and other businesses don't want to be obligated and say it would, you know, slow their business down and raise costs and that kind of thing. I think they ought to keep it on the books, and I think it's good that it comes up at budget time as something as an obligation they need to figure out how to fund at some point. They might have to kick the can down the road some more, but I think one of the things that's going on in this legislature is they're not just looking at cutting government expense, but they're also looking at ways of doing things that will help businesses, or that the business community says will help businesses. They change the workers' compensation element there, and you know, I think there's sort of a whole host of things they're trying to accomplish to kind of boost the economy at the business level.
And a couple of years ago, you wouldn't have heard anybody bring up minimum wage or sick leave because there is this tension. There's a natural tension. Do you want us to create more jobs, or do you want to make the business of hiring more expensive?
Why is the port in disarray? David Brewster wrote about Rob Holland resigning. Of course, the Seattle Times did a story on Sunday that basically by Tuesday
he's in a lot of troubles with his and by Tuesday he credit said, card and, right. and different things like that.
And by Tuesday he said he was resigning. Tuesday
that
or Wednesday.
A pretty devastating article. I mean,
Emily Hefter did some.
She did a really.
I think Rob Holland did the right thing after that article came out.
So does it say anything about how we are still running our ports and how people, you know, aren't really getting paid for these jobs, but
right.
they want them?
Well, that's one of the theories that goes around, that this job is so underpaid that it draws a type of person who is not going to be set up for success, shall we say, in such a job, and who you don't really want running the port anyway. And that's a problem with the state legislature, by the way. We don't pay our legislators enough either. So I think that argument is a good one, that if we restructured the way that port commissioners are paid, we might get better quality port commissioners. I have another theory that I want to float. Recently, we've seen some coverage of the port, but that's just on the back end of all these problems. We cover the port when someone is flaming out spectacularly. But there's not a lot of coverage of the port day in and day out, and I think that's in part a reflection of the shrinking journalism core in the city and in the state. I think the port beat is one of the first ones to go for any newsroom that's strapped for people. And so I think you may see, you know, here sort of a casualty of coverage. When the port isn't being covered as regularly, some of this stuff can slip under the radar. And I think, you know, I'm not pointing fingers at anyone or anything except the state of the journalism business and the economy, but I just think that's another contributing factor here. We don't have as many reporters with enough free time to go and make the port there be, in addition to the city council and Olympia and the county council and so on. The port ends up being one of the things that drops off the radar.
I just want to, just before you respond, I just want to say that the same criticism is laid against school board members in Seattle, right? They don't get
right.
very much. Lynn Barner wrote a column about that, your colleague. All right, well, there we are. The port continues to be a conundrum for all of us. Just real quick, this last point. Raising money for the mayor, Charlie Stadiker, he's got a good war chest compared to a lot of these other candidates. That's just because of the time we're in. It's just early.
I thought that doesn't Ed Murray currently have the highest amount among the mayoral candidates?
Is that right?
Yes, I think that he has the highest amount. Now he's frozen out because of the rules about raising money when you're a legislator. So the people who are raising money now are not going to be him.
So all right, I see. So it's too early to actually make any make any real connection about who's raising money and what it's going to mean for this race of Seattle mayor that's coming up. I will say that. I'll make that statement.
You go for it.
All right. Fine. All right. That was lovely. Happy Valentine's Day, post one. And
every day is Valentine's Day, as you said.
Every day is Valentine's Day. Keep that in mind. Uh-huh. Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger. Knute Berger, editor at large, Seattle Magazine, author of Pugetopolis, History of the Space Needle as well. Rob Wood is our engineer today. Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Amin Al-Sadeh, Andy Hurst, putting this show on the air with Daniel Anthony Goodwin as our intern. We'll be talking to you folks next week. And you folks next week. So we'll all be talking next week. This is Weekday.
To the Point is just ahead here on KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. We're online at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the City of Seattle, helping to reduce pollution in the Lower Duwamish Waterway by searching out and controlling sources and working with businesses to keep pollutants out of stormwater. More information online at seattle.gov by searching Protect Duwamish.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.